we're in. I know we can win it, so let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it, and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America. And when the war is over and we've won it, let's remember how we done it, so we don't have to do it again. There is a peaceful solution called the Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. America. The war is over and we want it. Let's remember how we done it, so we don't have to do it again. There's a peaceful solution called the Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. Now let's take back America. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and today's program includes Robert Wright talks about the death of the economy with Harry Chrysler. And we got that in Studio A, and Harry Chrysler's in, and we're just waiting for Robert Wright to show up. And they're going to be talking about the structural causes of the 2008 economic collapse and the political changes. Robert Wright also, I expect, will be talking about his early experiences with the Clintons. And he'll probably talk about grassroots mobilization and political leadership. And then after that, in Studio B, we have China and the hip-hop culture. Tavis Smiley will talk to Andrew Balin, a black entrepreneur who went from North Carolina to Shanghai, and he will explain his views of Chinese culture and race. And, oh, there's Robert right now. Okay.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Chrysler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Robert Reich, who is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. He has served in three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton. He has written 13 books, including The Work of Nations, Locked in the Cabinet, Supercapitalism, and his most recent book is Aftershock. Bob, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Harry.
Where were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I was raised in South Salem, New York, a little town about 60 miles north of New York City. At that time, farm country. My friends were mostly farmers. My father had a little women's clothing shop.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Well, my father, for most of that time, was a Republican, a Rockefeller Republican, a liberal Republican, an oxymoron today. There aren't any liberal Republicans left. He was very concerned about the budget deficit. I remember the first thing he told me when I must have been about 4 years old. He said, "Bobby, you and your children and your grandchildren will be repaying the debt that Franklin D. Roosevelt created. And I had no idea what a debt was, but I was scared to death. And I, but my boys have never mentioned FDR's debt, and I have a new granddaughter who has not yet talked about it. So I don't think that my father was right in that instance, although he was right about most things. And my mother didn't have strong political beliefs one way or another, but she had a very strong kind of moral compass in terms of what was right and wrong and kind of social responsibility.
And was there discussion of politics around the dinner table?
Not much. The big issue we talked about around the dinner table was the sales of blouses and slacks and brassieres.
But I believe I read somewhere that your grandmother was a real organizer in the small community that she lived.
Oh, she was. My mother's mother was a tremendous organizer, a community organizer. I don't think she would style herself as a community organizer, but wherever she went, if something didn't seem right to her or the community needed to do something, she'd just get everybody involved.
So where were you educated?
Public high school in South Salem, actually Cross River, New York, John Jay High School, a Lewisboro Elementary School before that, wonderful little public elementary school, Miss Boughton's nursery school before that, not a good experience. And then after high school, I went to Dartmouth College. After that, I was fortunate enough to get a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford. And then I went to law school at Yale.
And when were you bitten by the economics bug?
I was always fascinated by economics, not so much as economics per se, but as sort of one key into understanding the macro organization of society. Law and political science, politics, economics, it all was very interesting to me because I really wanted to understand the substructure. I mean, what was the system that held us together or didn't hold us together? And that was from a very early age. I had some very brilliant teachers in retrospect who got me interested in all this. The summer before I went to college, one friend, a mentor, a few years older, who had been very involved in civil rights, went to Mississippi and he was murdered trying to register black voters.
This was Schwerner?
Schwerner. Yeah. And I think that kind of shocked me into the realization that these issues that I've been playing with were not really playthings. They were very large questions, life and death struggles going on in terms of civil rights, and then after that, Vietnam and so forth. Remember, this was an era of Martin Luther King. John F. Kennedy had been president, Bobby Kennedy. I was not alone. I think most people who were my age were bitten by this bug, you know, that society had wrongs and it was our obligation to try to right them.
Just a side point here, because one of the things that emerges in your many works is your skills as a writer. Where did you hone that craft as a writer? Where did you learn to write so well? Was it just a natural gift?
Well, you're very kind to ask that question or make that implication, Harry. I always wrote. Even I remember as a child, 6, 7, 8 years old, I was always writing. I can't say. I can't point to a particular influence. I can't say that there was anything that I felt was particularly unusual about it. I just always enjoyed writing. I don't think there was a time when I didn't feel like I had to write.
What about your sense of humor? That's the other thing that really stands out. Did you always have that, or can you pinpoint a source?
Let's see. My father, who, by the way, is just turned 97. And he still is very funny. In fact, he's getting funnier. Intentionally, not unintentionally. I mean, there's some 97-year-olds who are unintentionally funny, but he is really very funny. He's very sarcastic, but with a real glint in his eye. So I credit him with a lot of that. And his father was also very funny. There was just it wasn't jokes, but there was a kind of a sardonic humor. Not slapstick, but exaggeration sometimes, and again, a kind of friendly, good-natured sarcasm that I grew up with.
Now, when did you meet the Clintons? When, Bill, you met when you were a Rhodes Scholar?
Yes. In those days, we took a boat together, a ship across the Atlantic, disembarked from New York. Embarked from New York, went to London, ultimately, and it was a miserable journey that October. I don't recommend anybody cross the Atlantic if they can avoid it by ship. I don't know why we all did it. That was a tradition. I guess that's how you met the other Rhodes Scholars. And Bill Clinton, I got terribly seasick, as I think most of us did. And there was a knock on my door, and he appeared there with chicken soup in one hand and some crackers in the other. And he said, "I hear you weren't feeling too well." I didn't know him at all. I'd met him very briefly in New York. And we started a friendship. He did not say at that time, "I feel your pain." That came later for him. But we enjoyed talking. Talking with Bill Clinton in those days was very much like talking with Bill Clinton later in my life. It wasn't really talking with. It was listening to. He was a great raconteur, a great storyteller. He basically wanted, he loved audiences. And I was delighted to give him an audience. I was amazed at that time. I mean, on that trip, he told me that he planned to become governor of Arkansas. Now, for a 22-year-old, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing next week, and the idea that he had already plotted at least the beginning of a political career struck me as absolutely amazing.
And then you met Hillary at the Yale Law School, where both you and Bill attended?
Actually, I'd known Hillary before. I met her when she was an undergraduate at Wellesley, and I was an undergraduate at Dartmouth, I think a year ahead of her. I had forgotten this. During the presidential campaign, when she ran in the Democratic primary, some reporter from the New York Times called me and said that he had found some of her letters, undergraduate letters, alluding to the fact she had come up to Dartmouth as my date. I completely forgot. I mean, it was not obviously terribly memorable, but the reporter asked me, "Is there anything you can remember about that occasion?" And I just... First of all, I was stunned that it had happened, and I thought back, and it gradually dawned on me that we did go to a movie. She was president of her freshman class. I was president of my sophomore class. I think I had ensnared her to come up by talking about it as a presidential summit. I was very clever in those days. And the only thing I could say to the reporter was she wanted an inordinate amount of butter on her popcorn. Which I thought, you know, I did it tongue-in-cheek. And then there was a long pause, and I thought, "Hello, are you still there?" He said, "I'm just writing this down." And it appeared in the New York Times.
And looking
the quality,
back...
The quality of American political reporting.
How do you compare Bill and Hillary as policy wonks and as politicians?
Well, that's a very complicated question, Harry. Bill just a huge extrovert. You have to be a wild extrovert to enjoy politics. And by that I mean every human interaction has to give you more energy than you put into it, so that by the end of a day, after you've talked or shaken hands with thousands of people, you actually end up with more energy than you had at the start. I could never do that. I once ran for office, and I would be exhausted at the end of a day. So he's an extrovert. He loves to, as I said before, tell stories. He loves to interact. He has a voracious appetite and energy. A little bit undisciplined. That's not a new insight. Many of his biographers have found that. Hillary is very much more disciplined. She's a linear thinker. He's kind of he surveys the terrain. She is careful about her time. She listens much more carefully. I would say overall, she is not only more disciplined, but I dare say although she's an extrovert, she's not nearly as much of one.
Were these differences apparent when they were both students with you at the Yale Law School? Or do these insights come later?
Well, I wouldn't have been able to talk with as much certainty about them. At the age of 22, 23, all of these things were embryonic. Their tendencies, I think I would have said then that she, just in terms of sheer intellectual firepower, she was probably ahead of Bill Clinton.
When you teach in the School of Public Policy here, what do you teach your students as the difference between policy and politics?
I try to integrate the two. That is, I've been a policy official, let's put it that way, in Washington three times, four times. Under Robert Bork in the Ford administration, I argued Supreme Court cases and I've reviewed Supreme Court briefs. And then in the Carter administration, I was director of policy planning for the Federal Trade Commission. And then I came in as Bill Clinton's Secretary of Labor, and then I've had advisory roles since then. And what I've learned about policymaking is you cannot separate it from politics. There's a kind of hubris that some policymakers have that somehow it's all about finding the best policy and then doing end runs around democracy and politics to get it done. I think that's hubris because I think democracy really does have a lot to tell us as policymakers. Politics has a lot to tell us about what is the nature of the good. It's not just analysis.
Let me show your book, because I went back for this interview and read, and I recommend very highly, Locked in the Cabinet, the story of your tenure in the Clinton administration. And I guess what I want to ask you is, what did you learn about the interface between theory and practice as you took the role of Secretary of the Labor? Were you surprised as you learned these things about, this idealism, this theory, when the tire hits the road?
Well, I didn't learn that. I didn't learn that idealism is sort of foolish or has to take a back seat. I thought quite the contrary. It was very important to hold on to your ideals because there are such powerful headwinds constantly forcing you into some sort of compromise that unless you remember your ideals and go back to them, like you go back to a well, you can easily be completely sidetracked. You can be worse than sidetracked. You can be just off in a ditch. So idealism is very important. I had been teaching kind of public policy at the Kennedy School at Harvard for 12 years before I took the labor secretary job. So I had a wealth of theory and, what one teaches in public policy schools behind me. The biggest surprise, I think, Harry, was how exhausting those jobs are. And I never taught about how to maintain your energy. Not just idealism, but just stay fully functioning and not be torn apart by all of these forces and not come home late at night and just be overwhelmed. I mean, resilience, physical and mental resilience is tremendously important if you want to make a difference. Now, believe me, there are people in Washington, I'm sad to say, who like the job title or like having the power, who don't take the jobs perhaps as seriously as they should. Washington is a funny town, Harry. It's a town where people don't take issues as seriously as they should, in many instances, take themselves too seriously. I tried desperately to do the opposite. I tried not to take myself too seriously, but to take the issues really seriously.
You write in Locked with the Cabinet, let me read you, politicians cannot be pure by definition. Their motives are always mixed. Ambition, power, public adulation always figure in somehow. Means get confused within. And now you're talking about Bill Clinton. Will Bill stick to his ideals in the pinch? Or will I find myself compromised simply by virtue of being connected to his compromises? Sort of an insightful view of politics and where things might go. Do you still stick with that description?
Well, yes, in the sense that there is a continuous tug between means and ends, to the point where some people in political life simply lose track. It all becomes means. They forget what the ends are. This is what I was referring to a moment ago when I said just reminding yourself of your ideals, reminding yourself why you're there. Because unless you have the capacity to continuously refresh that deep understanding, then you can become trapped in the means. Then you can become trapped in subtle ulterior motives that gradually take over your brain.
Mm-hmm. When I read your account of those years and the influence of Rubin and Greenspan, I had the following thought, which was, whenever a liberal is elected president, or somebody that the progressives might put a great deal of stock in, your book should be required reading to lower the expectations of the change that you hope they're going to bring about. So I guess my question is this. Because you had experienced this, were you less surprised by some of the disappointments that progressives felt about President Obama when he dealt with the crisis?
Well, I think that regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, I think there are many conservatives who are continuously disappointed by Republican presidents. The fact of the matter is that presidents have a very difficult time leading. You know, as that old metaphor goes, it's like drinking out of a fire hose. You're lucky if you can even take a gulp, let alone find your balance. Nothing good happens in Washington, in my experience, unless people outside Washington are mobilized and energized and activated and pushing on elected leaders. Even a president with the best of motives, if there is not that pressure, if all the pressure is coming from, say, corporations or very wealthy people who are supporting through campaign donations, then that president is not going to be able to overcome that powerful trajectory. There is nothing more important than organizing, mobilizing, activating, energizing people who share your views if you want the people in Washington to act on those views.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away, beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars all are empty, and the sun shines every day. On the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay.
Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey, too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm a-going to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
You can hear great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And now for something completely different.